Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. As we mark America's 250th birthday, most folks are thinking back to the founding fathers and perhaps what America would have been like on July 4th, 1776. But as a native Californian, I've been thinking about my home and what it would have been like here 250 years ago. Obviously, there would have been far fewer people, especially Europeans, as this was the early period of Spanish exploration and the creation of the mission system. But there was a rich and diverse population of indigenous tribes throughout the state. California is in many ways a country into itself with a geography far more varied than any other state. Grizzly bears roamed the coastal plains and inland valleys, and the look of the landscape in summer would have been far greener than what we think of as a typical dry season in the Golden State. To learn more about what this region would have been like before colonization, we're joined by Don Hankins. Don is a professor in the California State University Chico Department of Geography and Environmental Studies. He's also one of the few pyrogeographers in the U.S., a scientist who researches the effects of fire on the landscape. Additionally, Don Hankins is a Miwok traditional cultural practitioner with family ancestry to the tribe. He joins us now. Don Hankins, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Let's start out with that title because not many people have heard of such a thing. What's a pyrogeographer?
So a pyrogeographer is someone who studies the ecology and culture of fire, in short.
One of the reasons I asked you, well, the main reason I asked you to be on the show today is because you've been involved in an interesting project with the state of California and your work with the different tribal entities. Can you give us a little preview of what is about to come out and what you guys have been working on?
Sure. So one of the projects I've been working on recently is the fifth climate assessment report, Tribal Indigenous Communities report specifically, which is part of the state's fifth climate assessment work that's going on right now. Should come out probably around late October, November time period, but that's where we're at right now with it.
How often do those come out?
They come out every five, six years, something like that.
Okay.
So the last one came out in 2018. It was the fourth climate assessment, and that was the first time under the state's assessment program that included tribal and indigenous communities. And I was one of the co-authors on that report. The state came to me through the governor's Office of Land Use and Climate Innovation and asked if I would take the role as coordinating lead author for this report, the fifth climate assessment report. And I kind of said, well, I don't know if I want to do that. And they said, no, we'd like you to do it. And so I decided, okay, I'll take that on. It's been a bit of a lift, but it's been pretty rewarding as well. Just being able to connect with community and talking about the various issues that are so important across the state.
How many tribes are there in California now? Do you know?
There are 109 federally recognized tribes and a much larger number of tribes that are listed either on the state Native American Heritage Commission list, and then there are also tribes who opt not to be part of either of those processes for various reasons.
I see. So 250 years ago, if we were to, go around most of California, I would imagine that it would look a lot like it did 500 or 1,000 years ago.
Perhaps. I mean, there's definitely changes that would have occurred in, several hundred years' time that would be mostly a reflection of adjustments to, whatever the current climate conditions are. As we think about this time period of 1776, it happens to be occurring in a portion of time where we refer to as the Little Ice Age. And so it's a little bit of a cooler, wetter climate at that time. And even at the time when the state of California was formed in 1850, we're still in that time period. And since 1850, it's become warmer and drier. And so, as climate shifts, vegetation communities are maybe shifting in response to that, and wildlife communities are also responding to it. But the big underlying player is that indigenous stewardship is happening across all of those different time periods, right? So when we think about fire, which, you know, is obviously something near and dear to the work that I do, use of fire within the landscape to steward the landscape really helps to stabilize the communities in a way that they're able to adjust a little bit easier and sort of buffer the effects of climate influences because of the stewardship that's taking place.
Do you know what the latest thinking is on what caused the Little Ice Age, what caused that period of relative cooling to the planet?
Well, so there are some research publications that are out there that talk about the impacts of early colonization, early contact in 1492 that spread through the Americas with new diseases that decimated populations of indigenous communities across both North and South American continents. And based on depopulation, the lack of stewardship that then was occurring, that actually caused a massive uptake of carbon into biomass, basically, and that rapid change caused the Little Ice Age, based on these studies that have been done.
Interesting. So from that standpoint, it was an anthropocentric type of climate change.
That's correct. Yeah.
Wow. Were those diseases that have been well documented, brought over by the Europeans, especially during the period of exploration and colonization, had those diseases made it to California and the tribal people here in 1776?
By 1776, there would definitely be an influx of new diseases. I can't speak specifically to the effects of the impacts of like 1492 and that initial wave of diseases and how far they impacted California. But by 1776, for sure, there were diseases being introduced through the missions that were having impacts on populations. And then as we move past 1776, I think about like roughly around the 1830s, the influx of smallpox through fur trade, and then the introduction of malaria around the same time period had massive impacts in the early days before the state of California even existed.
Yes. I really want to focus on what was California like before the European influences really started to change things. But what was this place like when it was under the stewardship of the native people that lived here? And interesting to think about time in that reference, because you think about it as time immemorial, going back for very long spans of time. And it's just very interesting to me to think about, as I've gotten older, my point of view has changed so very much. Whereas when I was very young, like I wasn't around in 1776, Don, but when I was very young in 1976 for the bicentennial year, I looked on the wilderness areas, like, the John Muir Wilderness or the Thousand Lakes Wilderness up by me, places like that, as, oh, these are these pristine places untrammeled by humans, untouched by man. And they would often say that in the literature from the Forest Service, things like that. And now I realize, like, no, those places were stewarded by humans for thousands of years. And I didn't get that until I got older.
Right. No, I think you're touching on something that's really important, is to recognize that, because California actually did have quite a high number of native peoples living here before contact, there was an extensive amount of stewardship that was taking place across the state, from, our high mountain areas to our coastal areas, like, and everything in between had some form of stewardship in it. And so when we think about the wilderness areas that you're referring to, where, this idea that really comes about in the federal, development of the Wilderness Act in 1964, as, this idea that these are untouched places, a lot of those places, for the most part, would have had a lot of active stewardship in it. So I think about the Ishi Wilderness here and the Lassen, foothills region of the Southern Cascades, where, you know, there are, and its name is, you know, in the Yana language, right, where it's describing, you know, the people of that place. And, you know, there's extensive stewardship that would have been taking place there, managing for grasses and oaks and, you know, the conifers that, that live in those places, you know, collecting materials to eat and to weave with, and you know, there's so many different things that are happening there, and it's a real deep connection between people and place that existed across the state, and even today still exists, where people are able to have those kind of connections to what I refer to as country, which is a term that encompasses both land and water, because those two things are so inseparable. So when we think about, you know, what the context of the state, what did the state look like in 1776? You know, we're basically looking at a landscape that's very different than what we see today, because there is, one, there's a lot of stewardship that's taking place. The other thing is that there were no invasive, you know, a limited number of invasive species by 1776. You know, obviously when the missions were established, they brought in, you know, new species, including oats that now, you know, kind of widely flourish across the foothill regions and the valleys of California, and changed the whole dynamic. So, you know, early Spanish accounts in California talk about the hillsides being green year-round, and here we are recording this in the middle of summer, or, you know, beginning part of summer.
It's very brown,
yeah. And what are the, you know, main grasses that I see out there are those oats, right? Mm-hmm. So those oats replaced, you know, a lot of perennial bunch grasses and herbs and forbs that grew, you know, across these landscapes. And so you can just imagine this kind of beautiful tapestry of wildflowers and edible greens and things like that, along with the grasses that also were very important for, you know, as food and fibers that were being stewarded, you know, and then interlace that with the oak woodlands and the valley, and then the chaparral communities as you move upslope. And, you know, the grass was really just intermixed all the way up, you know, because even early settler accounts talking about, you know, the conifer forest being open with a grassy understory, you know, like the native grasses were everywhere. And, you know, we've certainly seen a major disruption to that with the introduction of invasive species and then the removal of indigenous stewardship.
Yes. And, you know, I'm looking out the window of my home studio, and across the street, there's a field, and there's a very old oak tree there. And that tree has been there a really long time. But the grasses that I see out there are the wild oats and star thistle, neither of which are, you know, species that are native to California, and both of which are problematic. It's a very different plant landscape than it was hundreds of years ago. And most people, when they look at, you know, the wild oats, don't realize that that's an invasive species brought over by the Spanish, with their horses pooping all over the place and, you know, the oats being distributed up and down.
Right.
Let's talk about, you mentioned that there was a large indigenous population here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I find interesting is that California had one of the most diverse and largest populations of indigenous peoples. Can you give us a sense of the diversity in all of the different people that lived here? Because it really is quite astonishing.
Yeah. You know, when I think about the state, you know, I often think about it, and culturally, I think about it from languages and where different language groups are found at. And so we've got a tremendous diversity of languages in California. In fact, California is second to Papua New Guinea in terms of the richness of languages per unit area. So and this is, you know, in the world. So indigenous languages in California were numbering well above 100. And you know, in early contact, pre-contact times, like there were over 100 languages being spoken here, plus the dialects within them. So, you know, I think about this in the context of like how quickly maybe language would change across the landscape, you know, and you know, if I think about the Bay Delta region where I have a great familiarity as, you know, being from that area, mm-hmm. is that about every 20 miles or so, there would be a shift in language dialect, right? And so then people would be speaking slightly different words in the same language, but slightly different words because of that dialect shift, or maybe they're pronouncing things slightly differently over a pretty small area. And then in the context of that, then you think, okay, you know, where are these languages being spoken? Where are people speaking a common language? And then there are fairly small areas of the landscape where a language is occurring. And so then people had to know the languages of the neighboring, you know, language groups as well. And so at that time, it wasn't uncommon for people to be multilingual, where, you know, they would speak several languages, maybe even up to 14. I think about some examples of that being up in like Northwestern California, where there's a lot of linguistic diversity up in that area, particularly along the Klamath and Trinity Rivers, you know, where that linguistic diversity is pretty high. And so, you know, there's just a lot of cultures that are coming from that. And I think that linguistic diversity is reflecting also the ecological diversity of the state. So, you know, thinking not only about the plants and animals and, you know, all those different, you know, critters that are out there, the materials that are growing out there, the living things, but then also the landform itself and how, you know, topographically diverse and climate diverse we are here. All of that is reflected in language, and, you know, language comes from the landscape itself. So, you know, unfortunately, we've seen a decline in those languages since colonization, you know, and I think back to, you know, like the, you know, 1990s when there were, you know, major surveys of who was speaking still in some of these languages. And I remember seeing reports where, you know, particularly along the coastal areas that were impacted by emissions, that, you know, at that time, there were no speakers of those languages. And I think the neat thing at this point in time is that there are now people who've gone back through archival materials and brought some of these languages back into use again.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, Don, because that really interests me. I was reading about it in some of the literature that you sent me, that there's this active desire, and I gosh, totally understand it, to recover these languages and restore them. Can you give us just some examples of things you know about that that's going on now?
This has been a trend, I would say, you know, like I said, referencing back to the 1990s when some surveys had been done, mostly out of UC Berkeley, I think. You know, there's just a lot of work that was around, you know, revitalizing languages, and some of the tribes, you know, were involved in developing like immersion type programs. And I think one of the, you know, non-California examples that really kind of inspired people was the Hawaiian immersion schools that were in the islands of Hawaii. And, you know, seeing that people were able to teach and you know, bring up a new generation of younger people who could speak in the language that maybe their parents and their grandparents and others, you know, hadn't really had that opportunity because there wasn't any, you know, opportunity to learn it. That's the kind of thing that's happening now. So I think, you know, as a language learner myself, you know, learning to speak Plains Miwok language and a little bit of Northern Miwok language, I was working with the last, you know, fluent speaker of that language. And from a context of understanding place and, you know, understanding where you live, language really is reflected in that. And so when I think about my own knowledge of language, I use it a lot even in my academic work because it helps me to have a different lens of the landscape. So I think about like specific terms we have for climate and seasons and things like that, that are really reflected from the environment that the language comes from. And, you know, unfortunately, English not being from this place doesn't capture that. And, you know, other languages that are not native to this region don't reflect that as well. So it's hard sometimes to understand the concepts that come out of knowing those details.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Chico State Geography Professor Don Hankins as we talk about what California was like in 1776, 250 years ago. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. And thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our visit with pyrogeographer Don Hankins from California State University, Chico, as we discuss what the California landscape would have been like 250 years ago. You mentioned, you know, how open a lot of the forested areas now that are just clogged with trees. For example, Yosemite Valley. 200 years ago, 250 years ago, you could walk across the valley and it was very open. There would be clusters of trees, but it's mostly meadows. And, you know, you could literally ride a horse from the coast across the state if you wanted to go from west to east. You could do that back then. But now everything's just choked with brush and too many trees. Talk about what that plant landscape would be like.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest driving force in shaping what that plant community would look like, you know, across the plant communities across the state would look like is really being driven by fire, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, obviously we've got natural ignitions that occur within the state, but from a tribal perspective, like those landscapes were pretty heavily stewarded. There are lots of trade networks that, and trails that exist across the state. And, you know, if we think about movement of people from, you know, one place to another to trade and to visit family and, you know, people coming even much further away. I think about the narratives of, you know, people coming from, you know, eastern Washington state coming down to trade on a routine basis and, you know, the plains and the desert Southwest coming, you know, for ceremony. Like people were traveling across the state and, you know, one of the things that's needed for safe travel in a landscape is to have a cleared space, right? So, you know, mm-hmm. you're able to see predators like grizzlies and mountain lions and, you know, just all of those different things. And fire plays a very important role in that. But fire is also applied at times of the year where it's not out of control, right? It's being carefully applied in a way that then facilitates a rich response from the landscape in terms of the plants that are coming back that then you know come to dominate in a place. And a lot of those plants are you know being diversified because of the application of fire as well. So, you know, like, yes, there are places where lightning is much more prevalent in kind of a stronger signal. But man, when you think about the lower elevations in particular of the state, like there's a lot of places where you can't rely on lightning to create those conditions. You know, in the mm-hmm. Central Valley, lightning is so rare relative to the amount of fire that was having to happen in those places to maintain you know livable conditions and safe conditions and you know the production of materials that you need to survive. So you would see patterns of recently burned areas and areas that are regenerating in different states of existence that span from you know the early you know species that come back immediately after fire, like grasses, for instance, to more of the shrubby type species that maybe exist in more fire-free time periods. And all of those things would create this rich patterning across the landscape as part of that. And then on the other side of it, I think, you know, fire and water, they go quite well together. And, you know, when we think about that stewardship with fire, it's also about the stewardship of water within the landscape. So people were actively burning in places to make sure that there was enough flow in springs to get clean drinking water and to make sure that the streams were flowing so the fish could return. And I think about like spring run Chinook salmon as one example, where, you know, they're going up into the higher mountain areas to over summer and then breed in the fall, and they need cool water to be able to survive. And so that fire helps to maintain that within the landscape, not only in terms of the base flows, but also in terms of regulation of water temperatures you know, like the smoke production and shading of the rivers and the valleys and that sort of thing. So it's a very nuanced knowledge base that comes into the stewardship of these places, and that also leads into the patterning. One other thing I would notice about the water, or mention about the water, is that you know people did a lot of work to slow water down and spread it onto the landscape. And so, you know, this occurred across the state in various forms. But I think, you know, as we think about some of the desert areas today, The Owens Valley is a really good example of this, where people built canals. The Paiute people there built canals to divert water out into the plains of, you know, of the desert, and then that creates more like a spongy type environment for more aquatic type plants to be able to grow, and really to have a very rich garden that develops as a result of that. So this is all stuff that's happening in pre-United States era, right? Or right at that time.
It's interesting to think about how the thoughtful application of fire on the landscape enhances water supply, because that might be counterintuitive to some folks. Could you just simply explain how that works?
Sure. So I guess the easiest way to explain it is to think about how all those plants that are growing on the landscape, when they're actively growing, they're kind of like having straws that are tapping into, you know, a single glass of water. And so the more straws you have, and, you know, they're being used at the same time, the water is depleted much more quickly. And so by removing some of those straws, by running fire on them, we remove some of those straws from that landscape. And that allows for more base flow to be left in the reservoir into the like water table that then, you know, feeds slowly back into our streams and springs and things like that. So, you know, paying attention to the landscape and seeing, oh, this area is getting overgrown. We're noticing that the water supply is becoming less reliable. You know, if we apply fire in this place, and we can reduce technically the evapotranspirative, rates in that landscape, and then release that water to enhance the flows.
One of the things I was struck by is thinking about how hundreds of years ago, people like your ancestors would have applied fire to the landscape. Because, like, I think about, there's lots of controlled burns, prescribed burns going on in the state, or, you know, even as we speak. And I was thinking about that kind of like, well, okay, the CAL FIRE model is they're going to consult their meteorologists and the National Weather Service. They're going to check on humidity, and they're going to check on wind conditions and fuels and blah, blah, blah. But back 1,000 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 250 years ago, the people like you, your ancestors would have had been so much more attuned to what's going on. Could you maybe talk about what were the signals that they got that it's like, yes, it is time to burn?
Yeah, well, a lot of it is based on what I just generally refer to as indicators, right? So, you know, when we think about indicators, they include things like, bird migrations and the arrival of birds, and, you know, sometimes they're celestial cues, right? We see, you know, that there's certain constellations that come into visibility, perhaps, and we're using those as indicators, or sometimes they're weather phenomena that we're observing that are telling us, hey, in the next couple of days, like, there's going to be a rainstorm coming in, and we can, you know, kind of correlate that observation with maybe the behavior of birds, you know, as an example, and kind of link those things together and say, oh, now's a good time for us to go out and set a bunch of the area on the land on fire, because this storm is going to be coming in. And so these are, you know, what I would nowadays, I think, in CAL FIRE's terms, you know, maybe in, you know, fire agencies, we refer to as predictive services. You know, we're using nature as the predictive services and those observations for doing that. And so there were people who had specialized knowledge in reading the weather in the old days, and, you know, paying attention to those kind of indicators that are there. And then there's also the biological, you know, other biological side, like, the condition of plants. So the phenology of those plants, you know, the timing and the life cycles of those organisms to know when they're going to benefit best from fire, and how do we, you know, like, apply fire safely within the landscape without having to worry about it racing away. Those were all things that were very well thought of, and there were prescriptions for all kinds of fire, from, you know, being able to reset the landscape in certain places with high severity types of fire where you maybe are killing trees to create more of an open grassy area. And then there's the, you know, kind of maintenance fires that are taking place with like lower lower flame lengths and cooler fire conditions, more moist conditions maybe for burning. You know, there's a reason for when and why you would apply fire in those ways, and people were in tune to that by paying attention to the landscape.
You mentioned earlier about slowing water down, and of course, here in Northern California and North State Public Radio's coverage area, a lot of our largest towns like Redding and Chico and Colusa and Oroville and Red Bluff are all along these major waterways, and where we're very worried about flooding because we don't want to flood cities. What did the valleys like in Chico and Red Bluff, and what did they look like from what your knowledge is?
I think that's a great question to think about. So if we step back in time and imagine, like, what did the valley, Central Valley, Northern, Sacramento Valley look like during a time period when there were not dams and there wasn't massive urban areas? Well, one is that the villages that were located throughout the valley were mostly on the higher grounds, so they would situate the village site above where the normal floodwaters would come, and like the hydrology is so out of whack now because of the dams, right? So we think about nowadays, like, oh, wintertime, there's going to be more water in the rivers. But in an unregulated stream, and a lot of our precipitation, at least, and particularly during the medieval cooling time period, the little ice age, is more like snowfall, right? And like a lot of our precipitation, even to this day, although 2025, 2026 water year wasn't so good for this, is still through snowfall. And so that snow melt is occurring later in spring into the early parts of summer. And so the peak flows would have occurred during that early summer time period and flood up the valley at those points. Which is very different than, say, an atmospheric river that comes in and, deposits, massive amount of precipitation in the early fall and floods up very quickly across the landscape. So people living on higher ground, so these village sites would have been located in those areas. And then, areas around those villages would have been stewarded in a way to facilitate the movement of water across that landscape and to get to lower points where it could be stored, but then also, infiltrate into the groundwater supply. So we've got these basins and sinks that are natural features along the Sacramento River in particular, and adjacent larger tributaries that come in that, would flood up. And those floodwaters would go into these basins and spread across the landscape and really saturate and recharge the aquifer that meant for greater reliability and a longer duration of water within the landscape as well. So it's pretty different, obviously, from what we see today. But if, you're a traveler traveling along, our highways like Highway 99 and Highway 5 coming through the Sacramento Valley, as you look at the landscape, you can kind of see where, the water would have been based on the types of agriculture that's being grown there today. So like rice production is pretty big, as well as the orchards. And the rice production would be more of an indicator of where those wetland type features were at. And then, the riparian forest and the oak woodlands have been mostly replaced by the orchards.
So you would have seen lots of like kind of temporary ponds. You talked about like the water gathering in these basins, and were those ponds used for, a kind of agriculture or?
Yeah, so the ponds that exist in the kind of the low areas were places where you could go for, harvesting fish, not having to be on the river, you could go out and harvest fish, and turtles would be in there, and other birds would be attracted to those places, particularly as they're starting to dry out. I think about going into summer months now, like one of the indicators that I look for, the American white pelicans, we tend to see flocks of them kind of moving about at this time of year, and as the water begins to dry up and there's, you know, fish are being congregated in different areas, those birds are being attracted to those places. So, you know, like these are the same kind of things that people would be keying in on as well in those areas. And again, fire is, you know, such a big part of that stewardship, though, is opening up areas and cultivating the landscape, you know, to thrive in a way that, one, it helps with the water distribution, but then two, you know, creates places where certain plant materials could be collected from. So grass was a very big part of traditional diet here in California, and so stewarding those grasses was really important. And you know, like each species maybe has a different time of when they're burning for when they're being you know, enhanced by that fire, and then add to that the other seed plants that come from, you know, the wildflowers and things like that. They all have their own time for fire, so this rich patterning really would have occurred across that entire landscape.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our interview with geography professor and Miwok traditional practitioner Don Hankins. We're talking about what California would have been like 250 years ago, at the dawn of the period of European colonization, when indigenous people deeply influenced the landscape. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. We're speaking with pyrogeographer Don Hankins about what California was like 250 years ago, when indigenous people were active stewards of the landscape, for example, using fire to cultivate a healthier environment. One of the things that struck me as just very beautiful and powerful was a diagram that was in the document you sent me. It was a seasonal round, which I'd never seen that before. And it was exquisite. Could you tell us what seasonal rounds are?
Sure. Well, I'm going to say real quick, so that particular figure may not end up in the final report because the text size is too small. So we're trying to figure out something around that right now. But I'll explain what a seasonal round is just to kind of illustrate.
Regardless, I'd love to have a framed copy in my office.
Yeah. I think the example that you're seeing is was done for the Yurok tribe, if I'm not mistaken. The idea of the seasonal round is really thinking about the movements and actions that are occurring across the year. And as I was saying, in relationship to language, like every culture has a unique relationship to place, understanding what defines a season and what are the indicators of that, and then how do you go about living in a place in that context of which season you're in and what activities you should be doing. And so when I think about this idea of the seasonal rounds, if we can kind of think about, you know, what times of year are certain things happening, you know, in the early spring, we see this green up occurring and the life coming back, right? So, you know, across a vast area of the Central Valley and the foothills, we have a lot of deciduous oaks and other trees that start to green up, and then birds start to come back in. And, you know, during that time, there's a lot of edible greens that are available and flowers that are available as food. And so people would target, you know, like going out and doing the stewardship to collect those materials and to utilize them and celebrate them through ceremony. And then as that green starts to transition to, well, I don't know, I kind of think about it as a hardening that happens in the summertime. So you end up with this kind of curing of some of the leaves that have emerged in the spring. And, you know, the nut production is starting to happen in the oaks that's happening over the summer. So there's, you know, different stewardship that's linked to that time of year and different materials that you're collecting. So, you know, one thing that I think about is, you know, in the springtime or in the summer months is like the prevalence of grasshoppers that start to emerge, right? And so they're there to forage on some of that grass, and grasshoppers were a huge part of native California cuisine at that time. For those listeners who may be thinking, yeah, they would eat grasshoppers, they're not really much different than eating shrimp. Kind of a similar flavor, really. But they were a huge part of the traditional foods. And so people would burn small patches in kind of a ring of fire to drive grasshoppers and then collect those grasshoppers and roast them and eat them. So that would happen in the summer. And then by fall, we've got the collection of acorns, and maybe we're harvesting, you know, some animals like pronghorn or elk or deer, you know, and like salmon cycles, like pretty much every season, pretty much if you're along these rivers, because there were runs throughout the entire year. The biggest of those runs that was most important was the spring run, but people had access to fish all the time if they lived near streams.
And it's interesting to think, Don, back, you know, hundreds of years, a couple hundred years ago, not really that long ago, it was even vastly different. Is I think people would be astonished by the number of salmon that would have been here.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty hard to imagine today when, you know, if you live by these streams, you can look in them most of the year and you don't see any of these fish. You know, and so their populations are way out of whack. So like I said, spring run fish was pretty widely important across the entire, you know, areas of where salmon exist in California. And yet there are some of the lowest numbers of you know, salmon that we have today. In like fall run fish outnumber those spring run fish by far. But, you know, it's like these were hugely important. But getting back to the seasonal rounds, is, you know, as we come out of the fall, you know, like there's a lot of collection that's taking place to help people prepare for that time of year when winter rolls around and things are quieter and things become more dormant and there's maybe less availability for foods. And so people would do a lot of preparing of foods, drying of foods, dried meats and dried, you know, greens and fruits and things like that. And so those sorts of practices would be applied for those, you know, kind of cooler, wetter, quieter times of the winter, and that's when people would maybe spend a little bit more time resting and following the cycles, as like many of our wildlife relatives follow the cycles and become a little bit quieter and restful during the winter. You know, people would do the same. Of course, that you know, that's also when like waterfowl collection would be taking place too, because there's a lot more wildlife migration happening or waterfowl migration happening at that time. So these are the ideas that kind of go behind the seasonal rounds and the kind of stewardship that's taking place. If I overlay fire onto that, you know, like fire is happening throughout the year, but I would say the biggest amount of fire is really being applied in that late fall time period to do what we call cleaning up the landscape. So like all the dead grass and branches that have fallen throughout the year, opening up the trails, all of those kind of things is happening at a much broader, coarser scale, if you want to think about it that way, across the landscape. And then throughout the year, you've got these smaller fires that are happening to do the grasshopper burns and to, you know, open up an area to access your favorite fishing hole. Those kind of things are happening at different times of the year.
And another interesting thing I was thinking about is, for me, I have special places that I like to go where I feel at most, you know, in touch with something bigger than myself, I'll put it that way. Talk a bit about the sacred places, because people all over the world through time immemorial have had this connection to certain places that are somehow symbolically important to that people.
Yeah.
And California is no different.
Right. No, I would say, you know, when we think about the diversity of cultures, as we've talked about, and then also the diversity of life, a lot of these things align in places that are culturally significant, as you say, you know, sacred areas. I think about these as being very important from multiple perspectives. One, obviously, for, you know, continuation of culture and recognition of, you know, the narratives that come from those places, but then also as like centers of origins for species and the richness of species that exist within the landscape. And they often overlap, you know, like a lot of tribes will recognize similar geographies as being, you know, part of those sacred landscapes, if you will. We call it, in geography, we call it sacred geography. It's kind of an area of study. But the idea of these places is ultimately often told through the narratives of what are sometimes called creation stories. And these stories are telling the beginning of you know, time, from first fires and first floods to you know, the peopling, so to speak, peopling of, you know, the time before people, if you will, when plants dominated, and when they came into existence, and how they were given instructions to people to steward in certain ways, come from these very specific geographies. And so these are places that I think we need to be still paying attention to and stewarding, because they do serve as storehouses of the diversity of culture and landscapes.
One of the things I'd like to maybe close with is to think about some of the damage that has been done in the past, but how some of that is being repaired in some ways. You know, when you look back at the history of California, especially towards tribal peoples, you know, we go through periods of extermination and brutality, assimilation at best. But now there seems to be an evolution towards partnership and working together, because I think finally people are realizing that there is this tremendous knowledge base that indigenous people understand how to work with the natural landscape, with it instead of against it. And I see all these, you know, hopeful signs of progress, like the Klamath Dam removals, for example. You want to just kind of comment on that as some of the good things that are at least happening now?
Yeah, I think as I think about the time that we're in right now within the state, I think in the context of the last century plus, we're probably in one of the better times in that you know, recent history of the region, particularly for indigenous peoples, because as you say, you know, there's more interest in recognizing the role of indigenous peoples as stewards of the landscape, and recognizing the value of indigenous knowledge and traditional ecological knowledge as an additive, and outright, you know, should be anyways, but you know, a lot of times people want to see it in the context of how does this apply to, say, Western tradition, and is that not enough? And I think, well, the lessons learned is that we need all minds to be part of this, and you know, like the indigenous knowledge side of it is one that hasn't been paid attention to over the last, you know, 250 years in particular. But I think that as we think about the solutions of living in this place and the challenges that we face around fire, around water, and those sorts of things, like the state has been listening more, and there's greater opportunities for engagement around co-stewardship of places, right? You know, I think in particular, you know, being able to come in and work, say, on state parks lands alongside park staff and, you know, and tribal communities to take care of things that are of shared interest, right? And being able to make sure that they're on a trajectory to be what I like to think about is like the best that they could potentially be as an ecosystem and an ecocultural system, in the sense of bringing culture and supporting that culture with that place. You know, so you referenced the Klamath Dam removals, and while I've not been a part of those processes, I definitely know of people who have been, and you know, and the significance of it is, you know, that, you know, those dams really impacted the cultures of the Klamath region, with the multiple tribes up there, you know, from the headwaters all the way down to the ocean. And when those tribes united to, like, really bring change back into that landscape, to bring flows back so the fish could survive, I think it was really empowering for those tribes to see those fish return in a way that, you know, for 100 years previously, fish hadn't been able to have access to certain areas of the landscape. And as soon as the dams were gone, you know, they were accessing places that those fish, you know, hadn't been to for that entire time period, and then they were back. And it's not to say that that those kind of processes don't come with challenges and setbacks from time to time. But, you know, I think we see the emergence of a healthier river system. We see an emergence of a healthier culture and support for culture, cultures in those places where these kind of things are happening. And I think that there's a great success that comes from working together to see those kind of things happen.
Well, Don Hankins, my favorite pyrogeographer in the world and a longtime friend of the show, it's always interesting to talk to you. I want to thank you so much for being a part of our look back at what California was like 250 years ago.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Can you say thank you in Miwok?
Mi'kmaʻdin.
Thanks again to our guest, Don Hankins. Don is a pyrogeographer and professor in the California State University Chico Department of Geography and Environmental Studies and a Miwok traditional cultural practitioner. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.